Renee and Michael as well. Very musical and very talented family. It's nice to be able to enjoy someone who has the ability and capability of putting together lyrics and singing at the same time. Not only do you, I mean, don't often find that talent, the ability to do both things. Well, I guess everyone is very eager, very earnest, very enthusiastic about this coming week. A week from now, actually, most of us should be celebrating the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. However, right before that, this coming Monday, we're all going to be celebrating the Day of Atonement together. I don't know if I should necessarily use the word celebrating. We're going to be observing it. Sometimes our faces are a little longer because the hunger pains tend to get at us. But be that as it may, it's a wonderful part of God's plan, a wonderful part of His holy day observance, because it pictures the time when Satan will be restrained for 1,000 years and the world will no longer be subjected to the thoughts that creep into our minds from that influence. And also that's part of the reason for the fasting that takes place on the Day of Atonement. I remember the first time I ever fasted, and the results that it had. I was traveling from Pensacola, Florida, where I'd been stationed, to Brooklyn, New York, to board the USS Buckner, which was a troop ship, and I was going to be part of the crew. And just a few months prior to this, I'd been reading The Plain Truth and had been studying, reading the booklets, and I'd concluded that, you know, I shouldn't be in the Navy. I shouldn't be fighting. I couldn't reconcile being in the service and the commandment that says, thou shalt not kill. And so at some point, this was really starting to bother me. So I stopped at the Pentagon on the way up and went to the Bureau of Naval Personnel, and I talked to some first class yeoman. I didn't really know who to talk to, and I said, you know, I'm facing a little bit of a dilemma here. I'm in the Navy, I'm on active duty, but I don't think I should fight. I don't think I should kill. I don't think I should be a part of this organization. And he kind of blew me off, and he says, oh, just go up to the, you know, get aboard your ship, and then you'll be stationed in a certain place, and then you can apply back through your own command. We're just an administrative arm here. There's nothing we can do. So I said, okay. So I reported aboard the Buckner, and we promptly, after loading the troops that were going to Bremerhaven, Germany, set sail. And that was the main route of the Buckner between New York and Bremerhaven, Germany. And I guess over the years it crossed the Atlantic 130 times, taking dependents and servicemen back and forth. And I've talked to several people here who are familiar with that port, and as a matter of fact, were on the ship. I don't think at the same time I was. But anyway, as we crossed the Atlantic, and it took 10 or 11 days, I continued to study. I continued to really be concerned about being in the service. And so I sought out the Navy chaplain, who happened to be Jewish. And I said, you know, I don't think I should be in the military, because I don't believe thou, you know, it says thou shalt not kill. And here is what he told me. He said, you mean to tell me that if someone was coming at you with a rifle and you didn't try to defend yourself, that you're not in effect killing yourself? It's like you're committing suicide. And so if you don't protect yourself, and in what he was inferring, that you pick up a gun and shoot the other guy before he shoots you. And to me, that was the most convoluted type of reasoning I'd ever heard. So I didn't go back and talk to him anymore, because I knew whatever I was going to request would fall on deaf ears. But during this time of study, I ran across an interesting scripture, and I'd like you all to turn to it. It's in 1 Samuel 21, verse 10, actually several scriptures here. And it's the account where David is fleeing from Saul. He was fearful of his life because Saul had tried to kill him on several occasions. And he told Jonathan, I'm going to kill him, you know, and called Jonathan a son of a perverse something because he was trying to hide David and was siding with David. 1 Samuel 21, verse 10. And David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said unto him, Is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? Isn't this a great warrior that has fought against Goliath and subdued him and killed many Philistines, tens of thousands? And here he is right in the midst of us, and what's he up to? And David laid up these words in his heart and was afraid of the king because with his reputation, he thought, you know, I'm pretty vulnerable. I'm, you know, in a place where I could really suffer some severe damage. So he made a decision. He changed his behavior before them, verse 13, and feigned himself mad in their hands and scrabbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. So he was clawing and scratching on the wall and drooling spit out of his mouth. And Achish saw him, and he said unto his servants, Lo, you see the man is mad. Wherefore have you brought him to me? You know, why did you bring this madman in here? Even supposing he recognized him, yeah, that's King David. But in his condition, he's nuttier than a fruitcake. I don't have to worry about him. Why'd you bring him in here? And verse 15, Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? You know, I don't need another court jester. That's all he's good for, is making someone laugh. And so chapter 22, verse 1, David therefore departed thence and escaped because the king didn't have any interest in him at all and just dismissed him. He wasn't any threat. And so I thought, well, here's an example of David, a man after God's own heart, and he feigned madness. I wonder if there's a way of feigning madness so that I can get out of the Navy. Now, just keep that thought. But I also, in my study, as I continued to study, I noticed that there were verses about fasting, and so I studied fasting and, you know, what it was designed to do and this type of thing. And we finally got to Bremerhaven. And this is just an aside, it's just part of the story from a chronological standpoint, but it was very interesting to me because back at that time, the Plain Truth had many articles about Germany and prophecy and where it stood as far as the nations were concerned. So I got off the ship and went on liberty one night, and I was just going to walk down a few blocks to a store because you know, they had certain things that weren't available on the ship. By the time I got to the store, I thought my ears were going to drop off because it was so bitterly cold. That's what I remember about Bremerhaven, Germany, at least in January, which is when this happened. Just absolutely wretched, wretchedly cold. So I decided, well, I'm not going to walk back. I don't think my ears will take it. So I grabbed a cab. And just as a matter of conversation, I asked the cab, or I made the comment to the cabbie. I said, you know, one of these days, Germany is going to occupy the United States. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. He turned around and looked at me, and he was kind of a grizzled old guy, not really old, probably in his late 40s, early 50s, but just with a hard countenance. He didn't crack a smile, just turned around. He said, yeah. You know, I thought about that later, and I thought, well, maybe he didn't understand English, you know, and was just agreeing with me. But I don't think so. I think he did. But that just made the hair stand up on the back of my neck, and that made me study even further when I got back on the ship. So we were there for several days as we loaded and got ready to go back. And like I say, I'd been studying about fasting, and I thought, well, maybe I can fast and get an answer to this. Now, I didn't totally understand what a fast was. I mean, I read about it, but I don't think I totally got it. But I did it in the best way I could. And so I quit eating entirely. I continued to drink water. So in the sense of the fast we're observing on Monday, it wasn't like that. But at least in my mind, it was a way of trying to reap the benefits of fasting as I knew it at that time. And so the first day wasn't too bad. The second day, it was a little more difficult. The third day, I really began to notice how hungry I was. Now, most ships or Navy ships have what they call a gedunk, which is kind of like a small mini store, a convenience store for buying donuts and candy bars and, you know, toiletries and that type of thing. And as I recall, there was one on there, but it had already closed by the time I started to really get hungry. And I'd noticed earlier that evening as I was walking past the galley and where they served the food, there was a kind of a little enclave where they would set out muffins and that type of thing, pastries for sailors if they wanted to come down later in the evening and get their cup of coffee and, you know, eat a donut or whatever. On that particular day, they had cream puffs, and they were, I could just tell by looking at them. I mean, they were still warm and steaming. And the vision of those cream puffs danced in my head as I walked back to my compartment and got down in my bunk and tried to go to sleep. And I was laying there and I could see those cream puffs and could smell them, and I just was going through absolute agony. So I finally decided, okay, I've fasted, this is it, this is enough, I can't take it anymore. I got up, got dressed, I walked down there, but it closed at 9 o'clock, and it was about 5 or 10 after when I got there. And I just, you know, my face and my mouth just dropped when I got to there. I could see them behind the screen, but there was no way I could get to them. So I went back and went to sleep. And the next morning when I woke up, I was fine. It was kind of like you, when you're fasting, you reach a point where you kind of, like I guess like running a marathon, you hit the wall. You reach a point, and once you're past it, you're okay. And that's the way it was on the fourth day, and the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, and 11th, which ended at the time we got back to New York. Just, I had water during that time, so it wasn't a true fast in the sense of a fast, but it was enough so my clothes were beginning to kind of hang on me, and my face was getting gone, and I had to kind of, as I was doing my duties, because I was still working. I was working in an office, however, and I would be sure when I had to deliver documents to different parts of the ship, I made sure I knew where all the elevators were so I didn't have to go up the stairs, and just trying to gradually, conserve what energy I had. And one night I got out of bed too quickly, and the next thing I knew, I was flat on my back on the steel floor, my head just ringing where my head had hit. It was just, I got up too quickly, And I guess that your equilibrium is disturbed after you fast so long. I just simply passed out. Well, that was the only thing that of that nature that happened. But I finally got back to New York, and after observing me for 11 or 12 days doing this and reading my Bible every evening, I was reading my Bible, there were three or four other people in my compartment, and you know, they'd always look at me as I came in. I think they decided we better check him out, so they took and sent me to St. Albans, which was a Navy hospital in Queens, a huge sprawling 55 acres that during the Second World War had been very, very well used. And so I was sent there, and I remember, and this is probably the scariest thing of this whole process, I got to the ward I was going to be on, and I walked through the doors, and the ward itself was probably from this wall, probably maybe twice as far down to the other end of this wall, and maybe about 30 feet wide. There were not any partitions on in the building itself. There was simply bunks along one side, an aisle of maybe 10 feet, and bunks on the other side. And as I walked through the doors, I heard the key click, and I in the doors, and I realized, you know, they're locking me in here. And I'm telling you, if you don't think you're mad before something like that happens, and you suddenly walk into a locked ward, you start having some real misgivings about the whole situation, especially when I found my bunk and there was a guy next to me, flat on his back, his wrists covered with bandages. He was restrained and he was simply moaning. I heard him the next day or so. They finally, he woke up, I think he was heavily sedated. They put him and allowed him to get up, and I finally was able to talk to him. Well, he tried to kill himself because his wife had left him, and he'd just gone off the deep end. Every day, the doctor and a couple of assistants would walk along in front of us. We'd stand at attention in front of our bunks, and they'd ask, the doctor would ask us, you know, how we were doing, and, you know, maybe some things about our chart, and then go down around the other side. Well, just kitty corner from me, there was a young Afro-American who was about probably 5'6". He was small, but he was very muscular. And I don't know why the doctor singled him out. I don't know if it was racially motivated or if there was some other reason, but he was always very sarcastic to him. He'd come up to him and he'd have this real sarcastic, snide tone of voice when he addressed him. One day, after I'd been there for maybe 4 or 5 days, he made his usual rounds, walked down, walked the other side, and he just no sooner opened his mouth than wham, he was flat on his back. His glasses had flown over and hit the floor and were all cracked and broken. You know, I think most of us too were secretly glad that that happened because of his sarcasm. Because after that, when he made his rounds, he was a little more subdued, and that was very noticeable. They took the man that had hit him away. I don't know if they put him in a padded cell or, you know, restrained him in some other place, but he left. But in any event, this was the type of thing that you were contending with people that that did have serious problems. Now, down at the end of one of the halls, not the hall, but down at the end, there was a small compartment, and I discovered a piano in there. So I went in and I kind of played when I had a chance, kind of improvised. And pretty soon the patients would come down and they'd be clapping their hands, and I'd play some of the old standards of Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and the tunes out of the 40s, and they'd be singing and clapping. And it kind of granted me almost a diplomatic immunity after that, because music is very therapeutic, as you all know, and when you hear something that you enjoy, it helps relax you, it helps soothe you. And so that was beneficial. Well, the doctors continued to interview me. I had these Rorschach tests I had to take, where you look at all these images of black splotches and give your interpretation of what they were. And after doing this for 8 or 9 days and talking to me, I had a clean record. I'd never had any problems. Advanced. The way I should have, they finally realized, because I told them every time I talked to them, I want to get out of the service. I don't believe I should be here. I don't think I should be killing or fighting or a part of anything that's doing it. They finally determined, I guess, that I was sincere. And so they moved me over to an unlocked ward, and I spent the rest of my time there. And they finally said that, they were going to discharge me. When I was a senior in high school, I had signed up for the Navy Reserves, and I signed an 8-year contract, which required 6 years of active reserves and 2 years of active duty. Well, at this point, I'd already served over 3 years of active duty and also 3 years of active reserves, so they discharged me to inactive reserves, which simply meant I was, available to be called. The time that this happened was very beneficial, because it was post-Korea, pre-Vietnam. I think maybe 3.5 years later, we actually had combat troops that went to Vietnam. But so the timing as far as the history was beneficial in my point, and it was in my favor, because at the time the Vietnam War was going full sway, I don't think they would have been quite as lenient. Well, turn to Matthew 9 and verse 14. We're going to be observing the Day of Atonement on Monday, a fast day. And I guess my question to you is this. I learned the benefits of fasting, although I didn't do it in quite the right way, but as John pointed out in his sermon, God is very merciful. And even though you may not know everything exactly, He looks at your attitude, He looks at what you're trying to do, He looks on your heart, and you're given His mercy, and we can be all thankful for that. But how many times during the year do we fast? In Matthew 9, verse 14, it says, "Then came to him the disciples of John, saying, Why do we and the Pharisees fast off, but thy disciples fast not?" And you know this scripture. Jesus said unto them, "Can the children of the bride chamber mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken from them, and then shall they fast?" Underlined. These are the disciples of Christ. They shall fast. And you think, that applies to us as well. Now, obviously, there are people with medical problems who can't fast and shouldn't fast. I was 24 when I did what I did, and looking back, it wasn't wise. But there wasn't anyone around to guide me or help me. I was kind of flying by the seat of my pants. Had I been able to talk to a minister of God, he certainly, I know, would have instructed me otherwise, and I wouldn't have done what I did. But I did the best I could, and with my limited knowledge. And in 1 Peter 1, verse 20, you don't have to turn there, but we're told that no prophecy of the scripture is subject to our own private interpretation. Now, if I'd had someone to guide me, I would have done things totally differently. But we are commanded to fast on Monday, and we're also commanded to fast throughout the year. I guess my question is to you, do you? And I'm turning the question around to myself as well, because I know the benefits that I've had over the years. As you get older, it's a little more difficult. I wouldn't suggest 11 days fast. Two or three days, I think, is the most that anyone should fast. But if you do fast, you'll be absolutely amazed at the results in your life. You know, it's interesting, at this time of the year, I don't know how many people I talk to today who we were talking about, how's it going, what's going on in your life? All this stuff is coming up just before the feast. It always happens every year. You can predict it. Things that you didn't think were going to happen, happen. And that's just the way it is. And that's partially, I'm sure, Satan's influence on the world and the church, and just partially, our own stupidity at times. But nonetheless, it does happen. Anyway, we're going to fast on Monday, the Day of Atonement, a time that we can all be thankful for, that pictures Satan being restrained, no longer able to influence us. And we can be thankful that's a part of God's plan and God's holy days. And then next Friday evening, most of us will be in our respective feast sites, wherever they may be, standing and praising and worshiping God and thanking Him for the mercy that He shows us, thanking Him for opening our eyes and our hearts and our minds to His plan, and giving us the hope that someday we will be living in and through eternity forever with Him. Well, Veronica is not here today because she's been battling the flu, but she wanted to be sure to let you know that we both wish you a great and safe trip to the feast, and hope that once again, when you return, you'll be able to say that the feast 2009 was in fact your best feast ever.